Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today our program takes us to Brunswick and the campus of Bowdoin College. We'll hear from National Endowment for the Humanities Chairman James Leach. His topic is civility in a troubled economy. This program will be archived online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can access this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Crystal Collins Judd, Dean for Academic Affairs at Bowdoin.
Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Crystal Collins Judd, the Dean for Academic Affairs here at the college, and it's my great pleasure to be able to introduce James A. Leach, the Chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. James has come to Bowdoin as part of his 50-state civility tour, advocating for the support of the humanities. Prior to his nomination by President Obama for the post of Chairman of the NEH, Jim Leach was a professor at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, an interim director of the Institute of Politics and lecturer at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. His relatively short stint in academia was preceded by 30 years of service as a representative in Congress, where he chaired the Banking and Financial Services Committee, the Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Affairs, and the Congressional Executive Commission on China. A graduate of Princeton University, the School of Advanced International Studies of Johns Hopkins, and the London School of Economics, Jim holds 11 honorary degrees, has received decorations from two foreign governments, and is the recipient of a host of awards, including the Wayne Morse Integrity in Politics Award, the Adlai Stevenson Award from the United Nations Association, the Edgar Wabin Award from the Sierra Club, the Norman Borlaug Public Service Award, and a Woodrow Wilson Award from both Princeton and Johns Hopkins. Chairman Leach served on the board of several public companies and a series of nonprofit organizations, including the Century Foundation, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, the Social Sciences Research Council, ProPublica, and Common Cause, which he chaired. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the Council on Foreign Relations, and he formerly served as a trustee of Princeton University. And a three-sport athlete in college, Jim was elected to the Wrestling Hall of Fame in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Those may have been handy skills in Congress. While in Congress, Chairman Leach was a strong and active proponent for funding of the humanities, especially through his work as co-founder and co-chair of the Congressional Humanities Caucus. Throughout his congressional career, Jim Leach displayed a deep understanding of the vital role played by learning, research, and teaching in the humanities in maintaining the vigor and the health of American democracy. At Bowdoin, we strongly believe that no one can claim to be liberally educated without seeking to understand ideas of truth, meaning, and beauty through the lens of history, literature and philosophy, music, language and culture, and the entire spectrum of humanistic disciplines. The college's renewed focus on the arts and humanities in recent years, with new faculty positions and curricular programming, along with major building renovations like the Museum of Art and the Recital Hall, serve to underscore our fundamental commitment to the humanities. We are particularly grateful that foundations and endowments such as the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and the American Council of Learned Societies have supported our endeavors in this area. But no support of the humanities has been more vital to our faculty, curriculum, libraries, and museums over the years than the NEH through the award of 43 grants and fellowships to this college. As the beneficiary of an NEH fellowship myself, I would like to express my personal thanks, along with those of my colleagues and of the college, to the endowment for their support. We are very honored to have James Leach at Bowdoin today. He has already graciously shared his time and incisive insight across the campus in a whirlwind series of meetings and conversations, and I, for one, am very much looking forward to the next installment. Please join me in welcoming Chairman Jim Leach, here to speak to us about civility in a troubled economy.
Thank you very much, Dean, and I'm pleased to be joined by Eric Jorgensen, who's your State Humanities Council Director. I might say that the NEH is structured a little bit like the State Department. We have 50 state affiliates, and they lead us. And so I'm very appreciative Eric is here with us today. Perspective is difficult to bring to issues of the day and circumstances of the time. Because this week is Constitution Week, I thought I'd begin with some reflections about several of our founders, particularly Jefferson and Madison, and then attempt to bring perspectives to their contributions to our history and describe certain circumstances of the moment, with the implicit question being raised of whether the democratic model that they envisioned is well served in our times. And let me just begin with Jefferson. As we all know, it was the wordsmith of the American Revolution. He synthesized ideas of the European Enlightenment and produced the greatest revolutionary document in history, that being our Declaration of Independence. And it contained three quite broad notions. The first was the presumption, which was quite radical then, that individuals are endowed by a creator with inalienable rights. The second was the follow-on assumption that because these rights are a natural condition of man, rather than privileges that were established by a civil authority or a religious authority, government could only derive its legitimacy from the consent of the governed, and that legitimacy was considered to be very frail, requiring regular elections at a ballot box to continue. And the third assumption was that governance is not the province of a few, and it's a community undertaking, a responsibility of all citizens. And if all men are created equal, it not only follows that rights must be respected, but so must the views of others. And the opinions of mankind demanded perpetual attention. Now we all know that these uplifting conceptualizations were imperfectly implemented when our country was founded. Our democracy at its inception provided lesser rights for women and individuals without property and no rights for people of color. Our history thus became marked in a way by three great debates. And the first was whether you could establish a country or a society or a polity based upon the rights of man. And then the second was all about definitions, whether the word man applied to people that weren't simply male or pale. And it took a civil war, a suffrage, and civil rights movement to change our initial governing structures. And the third debate is one that's really identified most in the last century, which is whether rights could be valid if there wasn't some sort of sense of opportunity. And since there's a debate about how best to establish priorities, taxing and spending in particular, and assure that everyone is given a fair crack at the American dream. The first debate has been totally resolved. The second debate has been largely resolved. The third will always be with us. And in economic terms at this time, that debate is quite rife. In a philosophical sense, I tie this debate basically to two economists, the one being the great liberal John Maynard Keynes, and the third, the great conservative Milton Friedman, with questions about how we best establish a way for an economy to function in such a way that there is growth and equitability and fairness. As we look back in our history, it's clear that the great stabilizer has been our constitutional framework. And what makes it so stabilizing is that it's set very firm structures, but they're also change accommodating. Which brings me back a little bit to the founders. And while Jefferson was the wordsmith of our revolution, Madison was the apostle of our democratic methodology. And like Jefferson, he was exceptionally academic. He read voraciously and was a deft writer. And he like the other founders and our country itself, were great beneficiaries of the greatest foreign aid ever given a society. That is the skills and ideas and civilized values and methods of our immigrants, as well as the ideas from the country in which they came. There was obviously initial hypocrisy in our values, and both Jefferson and Madison, for example, were slave owners. But standing together, the Declaration of Independence, coupled with the Constitution, wrought extraordinary change for ourselves and for the world. And I might mention here that everybody around the world kind of recognizes the separation of powers doctrine in the Constitution, and Americans kind of understand it, but very few people think it through. That is, the three great branches of government, which people know have been separated, the judiciary, the courts, and the legislature, and the executive, are designed not simply to be separate, but to have overlaps, and there is continuing tension between them. And then we quadruplicated the Montesquieuan model. That is, we have a legislature, an executive, and courts at the national level, at the state level, at the county level, and the city level, in very unique ways. And each has tension with the other branch. And then there is tension and overlaps between levels of government as well as within levels of government. And it's all designed to hold power accountable and to hold back accretion of power to too large an extent by any one institution at any one period of time. And obviously, there is an effort in this arrangement to hold every citizen accountable to the law. As we look at countries with which we abut with differences in the world, it's quite impressive that how many societies don't have this kind of accountability. That's also impressive that there can be democratic societies with different sorts of ways of organizing. For example, most of the continent is not a separation of power system, and then symbolically, Montesquieu was believed by Americans, but not by the French from his own society. But we're proud of our framework, and then there's a question of whether that framework is living up to its circumstance at the moment. And also, there has to be an understanding that power arrangements are, in a sense, abstractions, and what gives them the meaning and how power is emanates has to do a lot with tradition, and has a lot to do with the times, and has a lot to do with changes in tradition. And so we come to American politics, which has high moments. It also has low moments. And sometimes we see the better angels of nature emphasized, sometimes baser instincts. If we look at this last decade, it's quite clear, and it isn't just this decade, but over the last couple of decades, we've seen an increase in partisan rancor, and it seems to be continuing to build. And has to be considered one of our lower, but without doubt, not our lowest moments. We all know in the early 19th century, feelings were pretty tough. Words were exceedingly tough. We even had in 1804 the Vice President of the United States shoot and kill the greatest Secretary of Treasury we arguably have ever had, this being the famous Aaron Burr, Alexander Hamilton duel. 5 decades later, we saw a United States congressman named Preston Brooks wander over to the Senate floor and cane a senator into unconsciousness. And the background issue was a dispute about the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which was whether or not slavery should be extended to the western parts of the United States. Higher moments have been characterized, it seems to me, by expansions of political tolerance, lower moments by debilitating political discourse, often accentuated by racial, ethnic, and religious slurs. Jefferson, for instance, was described by his critics as anti-Christian. At the zenith of anti-papacy feelings in the 19th century, Lincoln was described as the lowest people could think of as Catholic. At the zenith of anti-Semitism, which was worldwide, or at least Western-wide, in the early part of the 20th century, Franklin Roosevelt was charged with being a Jew. In this century, Obama, like his predecessor, Sir George W. Bush, has been called a fascist. But in addition, in this period of rising Islamophobia, he's been described as secretly Muslim, and even his birthplace has been questioned. And so one might say, what's wrong with a bit of political hyperbole? And the answer is plenty. Some frameworks of thought define rival ideas. Other frameworks define enemies. For example, we think through the meaning of fascism, does it imply that someone really holds that people should be placed in concentration camps, or communists that be sent to a gulag? Does it really imply that they would kill other people for their views? And does it imply that if they're that bad, shouldn't they be shot themselves? Words can have implications that go way beyond the mere uttering of them. And so that brings up the question of civility, which to many people is kind of a mamby-pamby concept, but it isn't principally about manners. It doesn't mean if one is concerned for civility, spirited advocacy should be avoided. What it does require is a willingness to consider respectfully the views of others, with an understanding that we're all connected and rely on each other. And seldom, it seems to me that in the big picture, is there only one proper path that can be determined by one political party or one individual. And of all the aspects of life, public decision-making, perhaps the least, lends itself to certitude. Everybody can learn from somebody else. And that's why throughout the country, in the abstract, humility is a valued character trait, and why civility is central to democratic government. Now, the trouble is that the abstract and the reality are two different things. In fact, I will tell you, since I spent some time in American politics and a little in academia, I used to frequently be asked, what's the difference between the academy and Congress? By both friends in both of these great institutions. And I used to say that I give everyone the same answer and they'd all think, concluded differently. That is, I would say that academia and Congress had one thing in common, which was a lot of pride. And then I would add, in one institution for good reason. And those in the academy would chuckle and assume the other. And those in Congress would chuckle for the opposite reason. But in any regard, when we think about world affairs, it strikes me that the challenge is to bring out classic values. In fact, what we consider to be American ideals, like honor, dignity, and at least respect for neighbors near and far, because Lincoln said it best when he borrowed from scripture that a house divided can't stand. Nor can a house stay unified if it doesn't stay true to its own values. And so when I mentioned the Constitution and our heritage, I did so just to lead up to some courses I used to talk that I would summarize in very brief form. And when I was teaching, I developed some 50 what I call two-minute courses in American society. And I want to give five or six of them, maybe seven. So you have a feeling for what's happening today in an abstract kind of way, and then a feeling of whether or not this is what the founders had in mind. And the first course I call Political Science 101. And it's a mathematical course, and it's a very simple one, that if you take the last generation, we're about, if you use Washington's terms of factions, we're about a third Democratic, a third Republican, and a third no party. And what that means is that control of the two political parties is half of a third. So that is half of the Republican Party is about a sixth of the people, half of the Democratic Party is about a sixth of the people. So a sixth control the nomination process and party platforms. But if only one in four at most, and it's usually one in eight or sometimes one in 12, participate in primaries for legislative offices. What that means is, at big primaries, it's 1/4 times 1/6, or 1/24 control the Republican Party, 1/24 the Democratic, or in many cases, 1/48, or maybe yet, maybe even 1/76. But the point is, a very small number of people control. And then you have to ask yourself, who are these people? And in essence, on the Democratic side, it's kind of an old-fashioned liberalism, and it's been pretty constant for the last couple of generations. On the Republican side, it's a conservatism that's undergone some change. When I entered public life, it was a Goldwater-like conservatism, a kind of individual rights-oriented, skimpy on the purse. Today, it's a little bit more of a social conservatism with a heavy religious douse. And it's pretty uncompromising in certain kinds of ways. The second aspect of this, I call political science 102. And half of this everybody understands, and half almost nobody thinks through. But the half that everybody understands is that if two people in this room were running for president of the United States, and one was a Democrat and one was a Republican, it would be assumed that the Democrat would kind of move to the left in the primary, and then if nominated, would scoot to the center, and the Republican vice versa. But in legislative races, the first part of this is exactly the case, that to win primaries, it's pretty hard for a Republican not to be pretty sympathetic to very conservative instincts, increasingly social, and a Democrat fairly liberal. But in legislative races, partly because so many seats are considered safe with it for one party, and by so many, probably 3/4, it means that there is no incentive to ever scoot to the center. And scooting to the center implies reaching out to the other party. It implies using what is now a word that has more than one syllable, but is considered a four-letter word, and that's the word compromise. If one compromises with the other side, that is, doesn't stick with exactly the party line, what happens is one guarantees a primary opposition, and that is where one is most vulnerable for most legislative candidates in almost any congressional seat in the United States of America. And so we have an increasing attitude of there is no personal vested interest to compromise if one is a Republican conservative, or one is a Democratic liberal. A case, of course, I call Psychology 101 is that more and more people are describing issues as moral issues, and frankly, everyone should in any walk of life attempt to have moral opinions, but if issues are considered deeply moral, that implies if I might hold one position and someone else another position, if I consider my position moral, that means the other position is immoral. And when you have a moral-immoral divide, it's not only hard to figure out compromise on that issue, but it's awfully difficult to figure out how these people that have moral versus immoral views can get along on other issues having nothing to do with the one on the table at a given point in time. Another issue that I consider in the psychology category relates to this concept of globalism, in the sense that everybody hears it all, the movement in world affairs is globalist. And by the same time, as a congressman from not far from here, Tip O'Neill, used to say, all politics is local. And so you have this great battle underway in the United States and frankly in every society in the world between globalism and localism. And it's true that almost every global circumstance can have local implications, but it is not true that people think particularly globally in most circumstances. And so how one meets out these great distinctions between global and local becomes the great challenge in almost every serious political issue in almost any country in the world and almost any serious international circumstance where conflict may be at play. But my favorite courses are that I consider particularly American. I relate to a course I call Sports 101. We are a much more sports-intensive society than we sometimes think, and most societies have an element. And you might recall three decades ago, we had what was called a soccer war in Central America between two countries. That is, a soccer game brought about tension that led to war. But if you take America, the great statement that is that everybody kind of knows it's been associated with sports, but doesn't know the person. A sports writer named Grantland Rice once talked about winning and losing wasn't the most important thing, it's how you play the game. Well, in politics, the temper and the integrity of the political debate is often more important than the outcome of an issue. And what's interesting to me is that when I entered the political fray almost four decades ago, I used to talk about almost one-to-one analogies between sports and politics. And when I left the political scene, it dawned on me that these analogies had broken down, because despite what one reads in the paper about misbehaviors from a particular sports star now and again, sports has a much higher ethic than the political competitive ethic. And I mean this very seriously, because if you take Bowdoin College, the president of the university wouldn't hire a coach who taught his kids not to respect the opponent. In American politics, the equivalent of a coach is a political consultant, and there's not a consultant around who in a close race will not tell the candidate to go negative. They all do. In sports, you have rules. In politics, there are virtually none. In sports, you have referees. You've got to drop flags in football for clips or being offside, and basketball for fouls, and wrestling, which is, of course, the greatest sport. The referees decide whether people are stalling or out of bounds. Sports or in politics, it isn't that way. In fact, I'm reminded of a story in an athletic director, Hall of Fame member on the women's side once told the story of a tennis match he watched in which there was an enormously long volley in which there were enormously powerful forehands and deft backhands, and the players would run to the net and then race to the back line. And at the end of the point, everybody in the audience stood and applauded, and the two players put down their rackets and clapped for each other. Well, where do you see that in politics? I'm reminded, I come from the state of Iowa, and I used to represent the Iowa Hawkeyes, but we have another team in the state called the Iowa State Cyclones, and they haven't had a particularly impressive record in football for quite a few decades. But a couple years ago, they were playing at Nebraska, and Nebraska was ranked in the top of the country, and Iowa State at the bottom. But that particular game, the football gods caused a number of fumbles, and Iowa State prevailed. And at the end of the game, as the Iowa State kids were running out of the stadium, this group of red-shirted Nebraskans waited, and as they ran into the under the tunnel, they stood and applauded them because these kids deserved to win. And that's really nice. And where do you see that in politics? Where have you ever seen a candidate applaud the person who just thumped him? On a more serious note, in back to courses. I call one course Humanities 101, and I consider the most profound political science observation of the last century to come from a scientist. And it was Albert Einstein who suggested that splitting the atom had changed everything except our way of thinking. And you think about that, and it has all these implications. One is that suddenly we're in a world in which we are the first, maybe the second, but probably still the first generation of people that have ever lived on the earth that have the capacity not just to wage war, but to destroy the whole planet. And that's a pretty awesome thought. And can we think the same way in that kind of circumstance? Now we have 9/11, which is teaching us that the implosive power of small weapons can be awfully devastating to world relations, to society itself. Anarchy is a very dangerous thing. And then you add to it not only the power of physics, meaning the big bomb, the power of biology, the capacity of diseases to be manufactured for which there might not be a known antidote, and that access to these weapons is spreading and that or could spread even more gigantically. It means that as peoples we're going to have to think differently, both in our own ways and hopefully in the ways of others. Which brings me to a course I call Literature 101. When I was an undergraduate, the kind of the vogue set of books were four novels called The Alexandria Quartet by a British author named Lawrence Durrell. And one of the aspects of these books, and I'm not going to go into them, but one of the literary morals was that Durrell had written four books about a rather minor set of events in between World War I and World War II in Alexandria, Egypt. Each of these books was titled by a person's name. And each book was a rendition of the same set of events four different times, three at the same time period, one somewhat later. And you wonder to yourself, why do you read the same story four times? And it ends up that all four stories are totally different. And the moral was that to have a sense for reality, you had to look at something from more than one set of eyes. And you can take this moral and apply it to the dinner table, to a courtroom, to international relations, where we as a country may think something looks pretty reasonable. From a European perspective, it might look differently. An African, a Middle Eastern, an Asian might be different again. But where is reality? Is it only one way of looking at the world, or does it involve many? And if it involves many, what are the communications that matter to resolve and questions of policy itself? I'm going to end with one final course, and this relates to another scientist, Isaac Newton. Newton once had these three laws of nature, the third of which was that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, what you would shorthand in physics, actions equal reactions. Well, one day I was sitting on the house floor, and I came home to my wife, and I explained to her that I'd just discovered the fourth Newtonian law. And she looked at me a little quizzically, and she said, well, what is that? And this is a law that's derived from a pun. The Speaker of the House was a chap named Newt, and I was watching him deliver a pretty blustery and rather effective tirade against the opposition, and then watching my friends in the Democratic side, and it dawned on me that in social physics, unlike natural physics, reaction can be greater than action. And if I call someone in this room a bum, they might call me something harsher. If we as a society might suggest another society is evil, what will be the reaction that we get in response? That is one of the reasons that words matter a great deal. Now, you can have uplifting words, too. the greatest in American history, I think, are probably the second inaugural of Lincoln, when he talked about changing direction with malice towards none and charity towards all. I have an acquaintance at the University of South Carolina who is the chairman of the English department. And he's a rhetorician, and he has spent a decade now on a MacArthur Fellowship writing a book on the South African Revolution, and it's all about a word. And it's a multisyllabic word that doesn't seem to be very uplifting or unuplifting, just kind of a word called reconciliation. And he argues that in the middle of this great tension between the former government and the Africans in South Africa of native longevity, one side started to use the word reconciliation, and they didn't mean it because there was great hatred. And then the other side gingerly started to use it, and then they got trapped into using it. And then it came in to have some meaning that they all started to think through. And then things started to evolve. And then the meaning of the word changed with the actions. But when people suddenly got committed to this word reconciliation, it came to have extraordinary meaning. And so this professor, his name is Eric Dockstetter, he's written a tome on a word, the word reconciliation. And it's come to have phenomenal meaning in South Africa. And it's undergoing continual change today. In our country, I've become concerned on a branch of our United States government and the use of words. And what I mean by that is that if one thinks that our government at the political end has been erring a bit from time to time in recent years, our Supreme Court, which I have the most respect for, or great respect for, in its role in history, but from time to time, I think it's important to point out places where there might be differences. In the court, which has largely been a great arbitrator of important disputes and has made a mistake or two. In 1857, after all, it held that people of dark-hued skin were property in the famous Dred Scott decision. But a year and a half ago, the court held that that words had meaning of a nature that I'd never associated them with. That is, that a corporation could be considered an individual, and money could be defined as speech, and therefore, under the First Amendment of the United States, the concept of free speech to individuals implied that corporations had free speech, and that therefore, since money is speech, that corporations could develop new and more profound ways of fusing money into the political process, and under the assumption that more speech is good, meaning more money is good. But if you take out of Webster's, there's nowhere I know of that the word corporation and the word individual are synonymous. Now, there is a precedent in commercial law where there is some relevance to it. But there is nowhere in political law life that I know that that is the case. That is, our whole process that we begin with under Thomas Jefferson was that all men, meaning all individuals, are created equal. Well, corporations aren't equal. I mean, they aren't equal among themselves, and they're not equal between an individual and somebody else. And if you think that they are individuals for giving money in campaigns, it means that we have a problem of not enough money in campaigns, and particularly not enough special interest money in campaigns. And for a court to reach that conclusion, to me, is one that's been too shielded from reality. And so the ruling called Citizens United is one that I think demands reconsideration. And if you think about understanding America, it's better to go to poets and it is politicians, although I'm going to quote from a poet and one poetic politician, and that is, in his preface to Leaves of Grass, Walt Whitman wrote that the genius of the United States is not best or most in its executives or legislatures, nor in its ambassadors or authors, and I hope I'm not criticizing anyone here by saying, or colleges or churches or parlors, not even in its newspapers or inventors, but always most in common people. And then Lincoln, obviously, when he went to Gettysburg and talked of a government of, by, and for the people, he didn't talk about of, by, and for corporations. And if we move to a corporatist society, and that's precisely what the Citizens United implies that we should do, it has a lot of implications for the political parties as well as the political process. And for instance, because in this ruling, a union is also a corporation, it means unions can give as much as they want. And what it does is that it ties one political party almost totally to indebtedness to unions and ties the other political party, but actually both political parties, to various corporations. Because one of the myths of America in politics is that unions give exclusively to Democrats and corporations to Republicans. Actually, unions do give almost exclusively to Democrats, but corporations split their votes, split their money. They give to committees of jurisdiction, and they give to both political parties. Whichever political party is in control gets a bit more. But they go to the vested interest, and that's why Ralph Naper once in a while used to suggest that we don't have two political parties in America. When it comes to interest groups, we have Republicrats. But this particular ruling is dangerous, and it relates a little bit to the electoral process, which is more than what happens on election day. It's also about what happens between elections. And to paraphrase Clausewitz, lawmaking is the continuation of politics in another form. And in electoral politics never stop. It's just interrupted every year or two to count ballots. I don't want to go any longer into this, but I've written extensively about it. But I want to give some examples, because when one talks about the issue of civility, and I suggest it isn't just politeness, let me just give you an example of what I consider to be the most uncivil speech. I think it's awfully uncivil to call someone a communist or a fascist. But it can also be quite uncivil to be very polite. And let me give you a model of this. As a legislator, I spent a lot of time walking between an office building and the floor of the House of Representatives. And often you're walking with colleagues to a vote. And a nice-looking man or woman will come up and very politely say, "Hi, Joe, good to see you again." And they'll say, "Say, Joe, remember how we maxed out with you in your last campaign, and we really like to in the next, but by the way, tomorrow a really important vote is coming up, and we hope you'll vote the right way. And by the way, how's your wife and daughter?" And that's a very polite conversation. But implied is a coercive contract. And I really mean this in contractual terms. When people accept large sums of money from corporate interest or union interest, it's like a contractual relationship. And that person knows that they've received money in a particular campaign. If they're elected and they vote the right way, they're definitely going to receive more in the next. I mean, it's an ongoing contract. It's like a living contract. And if there's anything that people ought to pay attention to in America today, it's this problem of money in politics, and it has been compounded. And the compounding of implications has barely begun. But the longer this particular ruling, Citizens United, stands, the more the United States of America is going to become involved in conflicts of interest when it comes to interest group decision-making in legislative chambers. It's my experience that virtually everyone who runs for office in either political party begins with an absolute commitment to do the best for the people they represent. But the longer one's in office, the more one finds that the lower road becomes the one most traveled, because the other side does, and because the methodology is the same for everybody, and that methodology isn't exactly corrupt, because corrupt implies breaking of law, but it's totally conflict of interest ridden. And it's conflict of interest written because of legislative law and now because of judicial fiat. As far as the subject of speech is concerned, it has to be looked at from two perspectives. At the one end, uncivil speech has to be protected by the court but filtered by the public. And the other end, moneyed speech, must not be allowed to silence the voices of the individual, the people. And I'm going to, just because out of friendship, I want to tell you a story of a second court issue, because it moves me very deeply. When I was in graduate school, my closest friend was a lawyer, graduated from the University of Chicago, lawyer of the Quoth. He had wrote a PhD thesis at the London School of Economics on common market antitrust law, was the world's leading authority in common market antitrust law, worked for the antitrust division at Justice, started an antitrust division in the city of Los Angeles, then went into private practice. But he spent most of the last 19 months in a jail cell. And if you were to say, is it conceivable that an American citizen could be sentenced to jail for 19 months for telling the truth? You'd say that's preposterous. But my friend Dick, his name is Dick Fine, had a client, and he goes before a judge, and he says to the judge that he requests a change of venue for this particular case. And the judge said, and why would you suggest a change of venue? And my friend Dick said, because you, sir, have a conflict of interest. At which the point the judge said, you, sir, are in contempt of court. And we've never thought through this word contempt of court implies that without a jury trial, without formal adjudication, someone can be held in jail without duration. So for 19 months, my friend has been in jail. Now, he was released a few months back. But that's an extraordinary phenomenon. And the reason it is so awkward is, and the reason that no one in the judiciary wanted to raise a finger, was that he embarrassed the judge and he embarrassed the level of the judiciary. The conflict of interest he raised related to a very peculiar situation in Los Angeles County, where in all the counties in California, judges are paid by the state. In this case, let's say approximately $165,000. And Los Angeles County decided to pay them an additional $50,000, so they're paid $215,000, which makes them better paid than federal judges. But that's incidental. California has a state law that says that no judge can receive a salary from the state if they receive a salary from anybody else. So this violated state law. And California also said if you received any remuneration from anybody else, there is another law that says you have to report it to the state. And so this judge and none of the judges in LA County had reported these earnings to the state, and that they were in technical violation of state law. Now you might say, what's the big deal? Well, my friend Dick is kind of an academic, and he writes a lot for various journals, and done a study of cases individual citizens had brought against LA County, and found, and I'm making this statistic up, but it's in the general range, that over the previous 3 years of 3,000 or 4,000 cases brought against the county, the judiciary in the county had only held for the plaintiff 3 times. And so my friend said, this is a conflict of interest because if you're receiving an illegal element of your salary, and the people giving you this salary know it's illegal, you have a bond with them that means that you're unlikely to want to embarrass the people giving the money to you as a judge. Well, appellate judiciary held up the original judge and said he could stay in jail because nobody wants to curtail the power of a contempt of court. I think, personally, this is something that is worthy of note. And none of you in this room may be affected by this, but when you think of the founders concerned for individual acts of liberty deprivation, I think it's worthy of note. And I'm going to just conclude then with several concepts, one being in terms of our times. According to the New York Times yesterday and the day before, a review of recent census data suggests that this is a decade in which Americans have lost ground, that we have higher people living in, more people living in poverty, and the middle class has lost ground. This is an extraordinary circumstance. I do not think it's unrelated to the political system, which in terms of setting priorities and taxing and spending, has made decisions that are unbalanced. I also don't think it's unrelated to decisions to go to war. And if we go back to the founders, one of the founders, Alexander Hamilton, made a clear point of saying, even though it was deeply unpopular, that we ought to honor the Revolutionary War debt. Well, we've accumulated to date over $1 trillion of debt related to the wars we've been involved in the last decade, which there's no great historical review, and by the way, which will add up to over $3 trillion over the life of the people that have been affected by these wars in this country. But we are looking at a circumstance that perhaps for the first time in history, these are the first and only wars, and by the way, the two longest wars America's ever engaged in, that in effect are being funded through tax cuts. That is, they're defunded. That we've lost the discipline to pay for our actions. And we have no choice whatsoever to come to grips with the circumstance of increasing public debt. And then the question becomes, how do you do it? And most economists today are suggesting that we ought to put off most of these decisions for reasons of the that relate to Keynesian theory as well as other theory, and that the only way we can come up with approaches that actually cut spending in the future is to look at entitlements and look at tax reform. And so the case for both entitlement and tax reform is extraordinary. And then the case for looking at priorities comes into play. And what are the priorities of the humanities, whether they, in relation to this big mess, and that might be considered fairly slight because humanities are about 1/25,000th of the federal budget. But what are the priorities of domestic spending priorities? What are the priorities of age groups, the elderly versus the 50-year-old versus the 30-year-old, what is the priority of education? And here I want to go back and I want to end with this because I think it's just fabulous about another founder, and his name is Joseph McKean, in this opening of the college called Bowdoin, when he talked about the need for the common good. When is the last time you've heard an American politician talk about common good? He concluded a paragraph with the peculiar obligations of those people that receive an education to exert talents for the public good. And what you have in American politics today is a battle between interest groups. And battles between interest groups often have very little to do with the common good. And when you take political parties, often they come down for very real financial reasons on the same side of interest group concerns. But somehow we're going to have to come to grips to make decisions of discipline that involve attention to the common good, to the public good, not to the interest groups that currently play such a role, and such a role that is now becoming even more powerful based upon the law of the land and its the interpretation of that law by the Supreme Court of the United States. Thank you all very much. If anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to try to address them.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. My question is about this perception that many people, most people in the humanities, if not all, are to the left of center politically. My anecdotal sense is that's actually true.
Anecdotal sense about what, excuse me?
About the political leanings of humanities academics.
Yes.
That we may, I mean, I think that is that's probably true. But you deal with more humanists than I do, so I wonder, do you think that's true? And then, whether it's then if it's not true, it's a perception. Is this a problem, and what can we do? You know, is this an issue that this political perception of academics?
Well, I'm not sure what kind of an issue it is. I think there is a common assumption in America that most academics are somewhat liberal. Actually, I have found in my life that there are differentiations in departments. For example, I've never met a Republican sociologist.
Right.
By the same token, engineers are often much more conservative than other
sure.
faculty.
Let me. Well, here's
and so there can be differences. But I want to just make one other distinction that is, all societies at all times have an anti-intellectual element in them. And I am more concerned about anti-intellectualism than I am about whether someone thinks the general academy is more liberal than society at large. And this is a very dangerous thing. Now, there are also differences. I mean, at Texas A&M, I'm confident the majority of faculty would be more likely to be Republican. We have some Christian colleges that it's Republicanism is quite strong. So there are, you know, there's a great panoply of views, but it certainly in liberal arts, I think there's probably a little more liberal circumstance.
Just a quick follow-up. I mean, in one way in the humanities it might matter is that, like, say, in Islam, where very few people in Islamic studies are Islamophobes, and Islamophobia is a political cant or a trope. So then it's that if you say something, if you speak out against Islamophobia as an expert, and there's a political stereotype of these experts, and your expertise has now become politicized. Or like global warming. I mean, or climate change, or you know, creation and creationism, intelligence design versus evolution. I mean, right?
We have a point. I've never heard much commentary about Islamic studies as being liberal or conservative, but I'm not exactly a student of Islamic studies. Although we're all students of what's happening in the world. And we all know that there is an Islamophobia in this country that is larger than we'd like. In fact, my own belief about foreign policy is that in many ways, the most important foreign policy of the United States involves maintaining a respectful view within our borders of all of our parts. And it's that view that gets translated around the world almost instantaneously. And so if an Islamic citizen is poorly treated, that has implications for foreign policy. Just as we had this incident in with this Florida minister who wanted to do a Quran burning and initially was talked out of it, and he had involved the commander of the forces in the field of Afghanistan, the Secretary of Defense, the Attorney General of the United States, the Director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who finally talked him out of it, but they couldn't order him out of it. And then after being talked out of it, he came back a year or so later and did a Quran burning in another city. And that caused some shootings. Luckily, not as many as might have been the case. But instances like that, I mean, shootings abroad, you never know about. And then there are things we learn as a country. We all know, as we watched the incident with in Denmark when cartoons were improperly, or was it Netherlands, the prophet. And one of the aspects of it we never thought of as a society for most, but not all, Islamic citizens of the world. A picture of the prophet, no matter how positive or negative, is anathema, that they don't believe in idolatry. And we'd never quite understood that. And so that adds an extra element to it. But obviously, violence is an inappropriate response. We love cartoons in America, and we see nothing wrong with negative cartoons about our own leaders, about our own religious leaders, civil or whatever. But those become quite sensitive issues.
Thank you for most eloquently defining many of the problems that we have. But short of revolution, could you identify any politically expedient or rational ways to solve some of these problems that you've defined today?
Well, I think as a country, I mean, I particularly think it important to recognize, and this might sound a little odd, I think the best and the brightest let the American people down over the last decade. And that's in the private sector and the public sector, and that there is reason for the American people to be upset. And from a liberal perspective to be upset, from a conservative perspective to be upset. And so the rationale for public angst is real and deep. And then I think as a society, we have to come to grips with how you work together and work your way out of it. And it's going to be really hard because everyone is going to be affected. I mean, whether it be a well-to-do person who might have to pay more taxes, whether it be a poor person who is not doing so well, whether it be the middle class that's being badly constrained. And I mean, the census data that America had a lost decade and we didn't stay even, we went backwards. And we're coming out of this decade with debt that isn't based upon having built a new house, but debt for not having a house. I mean, that these are really hard circumstances. And so the question is going to be, how do we discipline ourselves in a way that is also humane and rational and has a decent set of priorities? And that's going to be quite difficult. And I suspect you're going to see some to's and fro's in American politics. I mean, with one side winning one election and then the other side possibly coming in the next. But I don't know that for sure, but I would suspect that. And we're also going to see, as I indicated to a group at lunch, we may see some third parties come into being. And I would be very surprised, in fact, I'm very confident such will be the case in this coming presidential election. And how that will help or hurt, I don't know. I mean, we're all going to have to wait and see how it works out.
I know we have lots of other questions, but I'm going to suggest that we adjourn. There's a reception in the lobby, and we can have these questions informally. I'd like to thank Jim Leach very much for being with us.
You've been listening to James Leach, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, on Speaking in Maine. He spoke recently at Bowdoin College in Brunswick. This program will be archived online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can stream the programs online or download as podcasts, a service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of our program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.